From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the future of organic farming in Michigan.
The whole point of organic is a sustainable approach to nurture the soil, produce food, and to reduce the negative impact on the environment.
And it's full speed ahead in developing automated driverless cars.
When we finally get to a driverless vehicle, we need to have great confidence in the way that technology is going to perform and behave and the reliability of it.
Plus, now that voters in three more Michigan cities say they don't care if you light up a joint at home, what's ahead in the move to loosen restraints on marijuana?
Pro-marijuana groups feel the wind at their back right now. They feel like they've gained some momentum.
And we'll see which parts of Michigan are getting a very early dose of winter. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Monday, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. Driverless cars might just be a futurist dream no longer. The University of Michigan has announced plans to bring a fleet of networked driverless cars to Ann Arbor by the year 2021. We get details on today's show. And then the temperatures are falling and parts of Michigan, yes, indeed, have snow on the ground. We ask if winter has already arrived later in the hour. But first, it's been less than a week since voters in three very different Michigan cities all approved ballot initiatives allowing small amounts of marijuana for personal use on private property. And that has pro-marijuana advocates hoping the votes will boost pressure on state lawmakers to legalize or decriminalize pot. Joining us to give us an overview of what efforts are underway is Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing correspondent, Jake Neer. Hello, Jake.
Good to talk to you, Cindy.
So you had voters in hipster Ferndale, conservative Jackson, and then right there in Lansing, the state capitol, all saying okay to personal pot use. And really, by large margins, some 60% approval in every city. So what has this done to galvanize the pro-marijuana troops?
Well, definitely it's made some splashes for pro-marijuana activists. It just seems like there's a lot of momentum they feel like at their backs right now, or wind at their backs, I should say. Some leaders in the groups are actually saying that they feel like the state legislature should really take that as a sign that the state is heading in this direction. It's inevitable, and they should do something statewide, either decriminalize marijuana or legalize it outright.
We've got some things afoot. Let's kind of take a quick overview. We'll start with Ann Arbor Democrat Representative Jeff Irwin. His bill would decriminalize pot and do it all around Michigan, right?
That's correct. And it's not just Jeff Irwin either. You have some very, very conservative members of the Republican side of things here at the state capitol that are also supporting it. Mike Shirky being one who is, as you might know, someone who really sort of spearheaded the right to work effort. And so you're getting people on both sides of the aisle that are interested in this issue. And yes, it sounds like there are some people that are already, that already have legislation out there. Of course, that bill has been it was introduced months ago. It hasn't moved. And that kind of brings me to my next point, that despite the fact that there does seem to be some movement in this direction amongst lawmakers and even leadership in both the House and Senate aren't so quick to just dismiss the idea of legalizing or decriminalizing marijuana, it still seems like it would be a very heavy lift, in my opinion, to get anything done anytime soon, and especially coming up on an election year next year. It's very difficult to pass controversial issues like that during an election year. So this still might be a little while out before we see any real serious efforts moving forward.
Then we have White Lake Republican Representative Eileen Kowal's Medibles bill, making medical marijuana legal in food and sprays. Is that something that could see the light of day and get moved through?
That's a completely different story, in my opinion, at least when it comes to dealing with some of the issues that have been brought up about Michigan's Medical Marijuana Act. And one of the reasons that that's different is this was a statewide constitutional amendment that was passed that created the medical marijuana system that we have in Michigan. And so the voters have spoken on that one, and most legislators here will admit that they, at least publicly, they say they don't want to go back on the will of the people here. So when it comes to issues like recently the state Court of Appeals said that medical forms of cannabis or pot, the active ingredients in cannabis, are not what's known as usable under the Medical Marijuana Act. In other words, things like pot brownies, candies, capsules that have resin in it that contain the active ingredients in cannabis would not be protected under the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act. And so what Representative Kowal introduced would allow these types of products for people who are chronically or seriously ill to use. And one of the big logical reasons for that is you have issues of people with respiratory illness. And right now, the only way that they can use medical marijuana is by smoking it. There are other products, like I said, candies and capsules that have oils, resins in them that do not produce a high effect. So it seems like there is a pretty broad support, at least on the political spectrum, for that. It was just introduced late last month, and it's still sitting in the House Judiciary Committee. So, you know, no movement on that quite yet, but it's still a little bit early, you know, to expect that.
And then we've got Senator Roger Kahn, Republican from Saginaw Township, and co-sponsored Majority Leader Randy Richardville, that bill to get the pharmaceutical companies to produce and distribute medical marijuana. I would suspect not real popular with the folks who grow medical marijuana and sell it. What kind of support is there to kind of get it under the umbrella of the pharmaceutical company?
This is sort of contingent on whether or not the federal government reschedules marijuana in general. But either way, it sounds to me like in the Senate, at least, the Senate Majority Leader is on board. And it's a bill that was expected to move through the legislature fairly quickly, at least through the Senate. Although we haven't seen it move quite as quickly as we thought. We might have actually kind of were expecting a vote last week, which would have been very quick. That didn't happen. So we're sort of seeing whether or not that moves this week. And if it doesn't, then there might be some big questions about it that would be interesting to see what's going on with it.
Of course, all of this activity has to be underscored by the fact that marijuana is still illegal under federal law.
That's true, and that's one of the things that's really caused a lot of problems with the Medical Marijuana Act, you know, that's led to a lot of confusion about what people can do and what people can't do, even if they are licensed patients or caregivers under the state, and has also led to a lot of questions about how this should be enforced. And you, with these local elections, like you said, in Ferndale, Jackson, and Lansing, sounds like those are, according to state officials, according to a lot of people, those are largely symbolic, because you've got under state law and under federal law, that's still illegal.
Jake Neer, Michigan Public Radio Network, joining us from Lansing. Thanks so much, Jake.
Thanks, Cindy.
In Metro Detroit, the shooting death of a 19-year-old African-American woman has many up in arms. Renisha McBride was killed by a white man on the front porch of his Dearborn Heights home. Her family says she was there to get help after her car crashed in the middle of the night. So far, the shooter has not been arrested. And as Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports, there are still many unanswered questions.
Let's lift her name up together. Come on, y'all. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride.
It's been more than a week, and people are still coming out to these candlelit vigils and these rallies to remember Renisha McBride. The 19-year-old Detroiter died here in Dearborn Heights. It's a mostly white suburb right next to Detroit. Police say what happened is that her car crashed around 1 a.m. a week ago Saturday, and then 2 hours later, around 3 a.m., McBride was shot and killed on the front porch of a suburban home. Police are not releasing the homeowner's name yet, but they are confirming that he shot and killed McBride. He was taken to the police station where he was questioned and then let go. He told police he thought McBride was trying to break into his house and that then his shotgun went off accidentally. But McBride's family isn't buying it.
My niece is gone. Now, right now, the way I'm feeling it was racist.
Bernita Spinks is McBride's aunt. She told the local Fox News station that she believes McBride was just looking for help after her crash.
You seen this black African young lady knocking, not breaking in your house, not breaking a window, knocking for help.
McBride's family says they even had to have a closed casket funeral for McBride because of the gunshot wound to her head. Bernita Spinks, her aunt, says it is unfair that her niece's killer is still free.
And he's out of jail? Wow. Could I possibly do that? Somebody knocked at my door and I pulled my shotgun out? Would I be standing here? No, I'd be in jail without a bond.
There was a lot of banging. There was a lot of noise. And it didn't sound like just knocking.
This is Cheryl Carpenter. She is the homeowner's lawyer. And while she won't give his name, she says he is white, he's 54, he lives alone, and he works full-time. And on the night of the shooting, Carpenter says her client was afraid for his life and regrets what he says was an accident.
This is a tragedy for everybody involved, and the homeowner is completely torn up. He realizes another person's life was taken. It was a young woman. And he is devastated by that fact.
So far, no eyewitnesses to the shooting have come forward. But Dearborn Heights police say they do want to arrest the homeowner. But the county prosecutor says more investigation still needs to be done. Meanwhile, attorney Cheryl Carpenter says people are making up their minds before they have all the facts.
Then you add the racial element into it. The case has now taken a life of its own, and it's not going down the right track.
Friday's funeral for McBride capped off a violent, weary week in Detroit. Afterwards, three women gathered in the church parking lot to talk about the service. They've all carved out lives here in the city, but they're now feeling like it's just too much.
I woke up this morning at 5 o'clock, 3 more. Oh, I'm out of here. I got to take the rest of my grandkids' sons, and I'm getting them out of Detroit.
Still, the rallies for Renisha McBride are continuing, and some protesters, like Dream Hamilton, say McBride's death reminds them of Trayvon Martin's, the unarmed Florida teen who was shot and killed by a neighborhood watch volunteer.
This is unfortunately the strategy we had to take with Trayvon. You know, people had to protest to get an arrest.
As this anger and this weariness grows, no one seems any closer to understanding what actually happened that night on the porch in Dearborn Heights. For Stateside, I'm Kate Wells in Detroit.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Buying certified organic products often means a heftier price tag. But for consumers, it can be unclear just what that label actually means. Over the weekend, we asked some folks at the Ann Arbor Farmers Market what their definition of organic is and whether or not they mind paying a higher price.
Fresh, all natural, nothing that I can't pronounce in my food. There's nothing crazy going into my body. It's completely organic.
I'd say it depends on the price. You know, exactly how much more expensive is it? I'm more likely to buy organic food from, say, a market like this than at the grocery store. Yeah, to me, it's really about the way that they grow and process the food. So I imagine pesticide-free mostly, probably non-GMO.
Well, as of last January, Congress scrapped an annual federal subsidy that helped organic farmers cover the cost of getting their operations inspected. And that is a key step in being certified organic. What does the loss of this subsidy mean to organic farmers? And what does it mean for consumers? Joining us for this conversation is Lee Arboreal. He owns the Eaters Guild Farm in Bangor. It is a farm that is certified organic. And Lee is on the board of the Michigan Organic Food and Farm Alliance. He joins us now from Bangor. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you with us. And here in the studio, we welcome Tom Becker. He owns Sunseed Farm. It's just outside of Ann Arbor. His farm is not certified, but uses organic practices. Good to have you here with us in the studio, Tom.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Vicki Marone, who's an organic farming specialist at the Center for Regional Food Systems at Michigan State University, also here in the studio. Thank you.
Hi, and thank you.
Vicki, help us understand how important this cost share program has been to organic farmers.
I think cost share program for the dollar value is especially important to smaller farmers because smaller farmers, obviously, there's a smaller gross income that they are dealing with, and often their startup cost is high per unit of land. They start small. They still need these similar inputs to a larger farm, but their return is going to be lower. For example, they still need a tractor. They still need management. They still need storage. They still need the equipment to farm, but they often have a smaller pot of money to start with. So they're dependent more on the actual cash. The lack of Farm Bill providing organic certification cost share also reflects how the country is feeling about organic in terms of do they see it as a value in the agricultural system? And the lack of that value is portrayed by not including that cost share. They say, oh, organic isn't worthy of receiving agricultural benefits. So not only the economics is important, especially to smaller farmers, but also the perspective of, oh, there's a value in organic, we should support it, just like we do other farming practices.
And we should also have you get everyone on the same page as far as just what the certification is about. What does it take and what does it do?
So organic certification is a process that has been around for 30, 40 years. It used to be by the state. Each state had its own system. Mm-hmm. Now, since 2002, the U.S. Department of Agriculture started its own nationwide system of certification. They have created the regulations, and then they certify agencies, independent agencies, the NOP, National Organic Program, NOP regulations. They enforce them by farmer says, hey, I want to become certified. It takes 3 years to what we call transition. That means going from conventional farming practices to organic practices. And then on the third year, they can go through the process of the actual certification with that agency. An inspector comes to a farmer's farm on a given day. The farmer works with him or her. They go through the farm, look at what the farmer is doing, look at their farm plan. And that farm plan not only shows what's going on this year, but what has gone on the last 3 years and what their projected planting scheme is for the next 2 years. The whole point of organic is a sustainable approach to nurture the soil, produce food, and to reduce the negative impact on the environment. So if you have crop rotations, meaning you're changing your crops from year to year, you reduce your problems with Mother Nature, the pests, the insects. You also work hard to, what we say, build your soil. It means improve the soil through compost, manure, crop rotations, selecting appropriate varieties to reduce problems like insects and diseases.
Now, Tom, you are not impacted at Sunseed Farm by this because you are not certified. Why did you choose to not pursue that?
Well, the majority of our food that we grow at Sunseed goes through our Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA, program. So what that is groups of friends or families that invest in our farm at the beginning of the season and then receive a share of our crop throughout the year.
Okay.
And so we're forming long-term relationships with these folks over the period of, a season or for multiple seasons. So we find that maintaining a dialogue with our members, keeping them informed about how we grow our food, can start to take the place of that federal certification. And if we're using substances that, we need to react to an overpopulation of a certain insect in one of our fields, we have to use a substance, a pesticide, to deal with that. We're using organically approved substances. And we like to communicate that to our members. We might use soap in our transplant production facility to deal with an aphid infestation. And we like to keep our members in the loop about that, both because they find it really interesting and they like to be engaged in that process and how we're growing our food. And we want their hearts to be with us when we're in the field doing that work. So, and instead of just relying on that word organic, we really have the opportunity to engage with them about the process of farming and how we grow food. Not that that's not there for farmers who are certified organic, but for example, if somebody walks up to me at market and says, is your food organic? The answer might be yes. My answer is, no, we're not certified organic. Let me talk to you about how we do grow our food.
So you talk about the practices.
Exactly.
And the way you do it.
Yep.
And so this kind of, I think, opens up the question, just what does organic mean? Is it clearly defined, or is this a fluid type of thing? Lee, what are your thoughts?
I'm more into the fluid, community-based definition of organic. Of course, now the word is codified using the National Organic Program standards, which itself is sort of fluid. I mean, there are new substances that are allowed or disallowed, kind of on the margins of the standards. But my definition goes back to 60s and 70s when the word started being used, and that is something defined by the people who are using the word, and something is defined by the people who are farming that way.
It sounds like it's something defined by the growers and the consumers, the kind of relationship that that you have both built with your customers.
Right, right.
Excuse me. I think from the legal perspective, if you will, or the NOP perspective, the definition of organic is varies amongst the agencies. Some agencies, certifying agencies, these are the companies that you as a farmer go and pay and work with them on records and having the inspection. Some agencies are more strict, or they take the interpretation of the law a little differently than another agency. And the, you know, the word gets out, really. The farmers know, oh, this agency is very strict. And they really require you to have not just 20 feet of buffer zone, but 25 feet of buffer zone, which is the space between a conventional and organic field. And so that definition, there's wiggle room. I mean, look at our weather. Our food production is based on our weather. If our weather was fixed, well, things would be a lot easier. We know that the year before last, or this last season, that we wouldn't have apples. But we didn't know that because Mother Nature threw her curveball and we ended up with hardly any fruit out of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be wiggle room in that system, that there's so much questionability from year to year.
So it sounds like this is, when we use that word organic, it is a marketing tool, first and foremost, or not?
Yeah. For us, being certified saves a lot of breath. But if you don't want to save your breath, like Tom, which I think is a good idea, especially when you're a new farm, you want to use that opportunity to communicate what's happening on your farm and how you grow things.
But I think the certification is also important for those who are not selling direct to customer.
It's
critical for the wholesalers who are buying organic and then selling it to a customer. They don't know that farmer, and the farmer doesn't know the customer. So that label allows that permission of knowledge.
And Tom, I could see you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, what makes that work for us is when we go to market, you know, I'm standing right there and we can, you know, look them in the eye and talk to them about the food. And right now, our farm is, we're coming into our fourth winter right now, looking to sort of diversify our marketing and maybe start to look at some of the wholesale opportunities that are out there. That's when I think it needs to have that stamp organic on it, where they can't really tell the story of the individual farm where it's being produced.
Lee, I have to ask, what do certified organic farmers such as yourself think about the farms that like Tom's, use organic practice but don't go through with certification?
That brings up a good point. You know, for me, I'm all for doing organic any way possible. Like, I'm not a huge proponent of certification. I definitely see it as a marketing advantage in certain environments. But I do see there being maybe needless conflict between certified and non-certified farms that are growing organically. For me, around Kalamazoo, there's been a couple farms that have dabbled with parting from certification, and they end up coming back because it was more trouble. There's farms that parted with certification and felt like it was a good thing, and it saved them time and hassle, and didn't really lose them any of their customer base.
I can tell, Vicki, from your perspective at Michigan State, you are very anxious to make a comment.
Well, the past MOFA conference, the Michigan Organic Food and Farm Alliance conference, was a great example of this. We had many discrepancies of interpretation of the value of organic. We had discrepancies of what was worth it and what wasn't. And there was a large group of farmers who are practicing organic but are not certified. And then there was a large group there that are dye-in-the-wool certified organic, and they've been certified organic since the get-go. I find to make everybody happy, if you will, there's value in both. A lot of it is a marketing tool. But also, I tell people when I present about certification, if it's you're very passionate about the fact that to say I am organic, I have certified my farm, or if you have a market, or hopefully a combination of both. But those who don't certify, just like Tom is running into the dilemma now, if he does wholesale, he will not be able to sell that as organic.
I think an important point also is, organic is a baseline level of standards for practices. And, one thing Vicki brought up is that, you know, there are big differences between different certifying agencies. From the legal perspective, organic means one thing, but it means a different thing to consumers. And
yes,
there are a lot of symbols that are used in association with advertising around organic
even
products.
Misused.
Yeah, that mean different things to different people. So, you know, one person might view the word organic as meaning healthy, or one person might mean think that it means good for the environment, or one person thinks that it might mean more of an authentic style of farming,
mm-hmm.
when really it doesn't mean those things. It means very specific things having to do with, you know, what substances are being used and different, you know, different practices associated with farming. And so I think from the consumer's point of view, if you're looking to buy organic, what are you really looking for? And how can you really understand if that's the case if you're getting those things when you buy an organic product? And I think one way is, instead of just relying on that term organic, accept that for what it is and the baseline level of standards that it is, but also do your own research, find out where that food is coming from. It, when possible, find locally produced products where you can, you know, understand the agricultural systems, the ecological systems that food is being grown from.
I'd like to pivot this a little bit to kind of go into what you've brought up. What do each of you feel needs to happen to make organic food more widely available and at more competitive prices? So for someone who does not live near a farmer's market or have the discretionary income to shop in that pricey organic food section at their grocery store, does that not turn organic food into something available to a relatively elite market?
That's right. That's the big challenge of the fact that you are – the farmer is expecting a premium. And Tom suggested for a person to go and not only pay the price but seek it out, do research. And if we had to do research every time we want to eat, the average person doesn't have that opportunity. And access to food is probably one of the big deficits in our food system when it comes to higher quality, mm-hmm. higher value, depending on your perspective. I hope organic is better for the environment. You know, of course, it's every farmer for him or herself in terms of the practices. And the inspector goes there one time per year.
Yeah.
And what you wrote down, you know, the big brother isn't sitting on your shoulder watching you if it's correct or not. So it's a lot of honor system. And without that honor, that personal integrity, the system doesn't hold water.
Let me hear from our farmers. Lee, I'll start with you.
Cool. So it seems to me that the reason we've gotten used to cheap food has to do with policy. You know, I mean, as a nation, we asked our government to deliver cheap food, and it has. So I think collectively we have to decide that we want organic food to cost less and then make policy decisions in that direction. I don't know if that's going to happen, so it seems like, as an organic farmer, I'd like to invite consumers to come our way a little bit and put up with maybe some inconvenience while shopping for food, like you might have to buy your food outside, like at a farmer's market, to get a better deal. Or you might have to come around the backside of the table to get a case of some seconds to watch the price go down and to make it more accessible. I think organic farmers have done not all we can, but close to all we can to wring out costs and be more efficient on the farm side of things. So I don't know that there's going to be a lot more opportunity to reduce costs of production on a lot of these foods. But most of us, especially farmers that are engaging and dynamic and willing to move around a bit, are up for changes in the food system that would enhance people's access to it. Like, we're not out here to prevent people from eating our food. We want that to happen. We just want to make a living, you know.
And Tom Becker, you get the final word.
Yeah, I think that one way to bring down that cost for the consumer is to really look for those direct markets. So looking for farmers markets, going to your local farmers markets, if you have CSAs available in your area, engaging directly with your farmer, entering these kinds of relationships directly with farmers, whether you're buying directly at farmers markets or through community-supported agriculture, can be really, really a way to share the risk of farming and share that you know, extra time savings that we get on the farming end of things.
Good insights and good conversation from all of you. And I know we could keep talking organic. Lee Arboreal owns Eaters Guild Farm. He joined us from Bangor. Tom Becker owns Sunseed Farm just outside of Ann Arbor. And Vicki Marone, an organic farming specialist at the Center for Regional Food Systems at Michigan State University. Thank you so much to all three of you for joining us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you. This was great.
Thank you. Great.
So, how important or not is buying organic to you? Do you mind paying a higher price for organic food? Well, we'd love to hear from you. You can let us know on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can always find us at our website, michiganradio.org. And just click on the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time now for a little told you so from MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. You may recall back on Halloween, he predicted a very early dose of lake effect snow and temps that feel more like Christmas than mid-November. And Mark Torregrossa joining us today from Interlaken, looking at the weather around the state for this November 11th. It does seem like you called it.
It does. And, you know, this wouldn't be really out of the ordinary for the state of Michigan, but I think it's, again, just a preview of how easy the cold air is going to come down this year. And that means that a couple of weeks from now, when the next batch of cold comes down, the lake effect will be even heavier. Here in Interlaken, we can't see the ground. It's white. So we're getting the snow here, and probably we'll end up with about 3 or 4 inches by the time it's all done.
And we can thank that big blob of cold Canadian air you've been talking about, right?
Yeah, that is the source. It's still up there in Canada, continues to build, and every cold front that comes down now will bring an easier and colder chunk of air down toward us. So there's no looking back now. 6 months of this, we can enjoy.
It's here. Now, you don't have to necessarily be living in the UP or along the shoreline in West Michigan either to possibly have to deal with some snowflakes.
No, we've got a strong cold front, and it's moving through the state from north to south now. It'll be out of the state by later this evening, but right on the back edge of the rain, it changes over to snow. And I was actually quite surprised, but up here in the Traverse City area, I don't want to say the roads are slick, but they certainly didn't just totally melt off. There's slush on them, and you got to remember how to drive in the winter.
Well, Mark Torregrossa, give us an idea, just looking through today into tonight and on to Tuesday. Who'll be getting the most snow? How much?
Most snow falls around the Traverse City area up through Kalkaska, Gaylord, and probably around 3 to 5 inches of snow. And then up in the UP in the snow belts there, there's a lake effect snow watch, maybe up to 8 inches there with 30-mile-an-hour winds and blowing and drifting.
Well, that has to be.
That sounds fun, doesn't
it? That sounds a lot. Well, I got to say, this has to be encouraging to ski operators and to skiers. There's a lot of money that needs, that can be made when it snows and the conditions are right.
You know, most certainly, when the cold hits, they can start making the snow with the snow guns, and it's not that expensive. So they might get a little help from Mother Nature, but the main thing is they like seeing the cold. They turn the snow guns on and they start building the base, and we'll probably be snowing here in Michigan a lot earlier than we have been in some years.
So it has to feel good to be right, Mark? Because Michigan's changeable weather can so easily make a fool out of the best meteorologist.
I never try to say that, because that means the next day I've made a fool. So you say it, and I will just nod.
MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa joining us from snowy Interlaken. Thanks so much, Mark.
Okay.
Imagine driving through Ann Arbor, glancing over at the car next to you, only to realize that driver does not have his or her hands anywhere near the steering wheel, and yet the car is moving along in traffic just fine. That could happen in just a few short years. The University of Michigan has announced plans to bring a fleet of networked driverless cars to Ann Arbor by 2021. Here to talk about what that would look like in the streets of Ann Arbor and what it would mean to drivers everywhere is the director of the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute, Peter Swetman. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So let's start by examining just what we're talking about when we use that term driverless cars. Would it perhaps be more accurate to call them self-driving cars? Because there is someone sitting there, right?
So there's a whole range of things that are going to happen. So we're starting to see some level of automation in vehicles today. And in fact, the USDOT has been kind enough to identify 4 different levels of automation going forward. So we tend to call them automated vehicles because it covers the whole range. But eventually you get to something that's literally driverless. But there are various stages going through where, you know, we take our hands off the wheel, we take our feet off the pedals, and we take our eyes off the road. So those three elements are pretty important stages as we move through to, as you described it, the driverless vehicle.
Now, I'm interested as far as how far along is the technology?
Well, technology is pretty good. I mean, we still have challenges, and one of the challenges is the cost of the technology. So you've probably heard about vehicles that are so-called autonomous vehicles that have enough sensors on them in order to operate without reference to any other form of communication to the vehicle or any other form of technology. So that's a pretty high bar, and at the moment is pretty cost prohibitive. What we're really interested in is the convergence between connected vehicles, and we have nearly 3,000 of those now operating in Ann Arbor, convergence of that connectivity with increasing amounts of automation. And the connectivity makes that task easier, it makes it safer, and it also reduces the cost, because the actual connectivity, what that really represents is a very powerful and relatively low-cost additional sensor for the vehicle. So we think that the connectivity is a key ingredient in this as we move forward and we get to more automated vehicles.
Peter, you mentioned the safety pilot project with these some 3,000 connected vehicles in the Ann Arbor area. What does it look like on a day-to-day basis, and what have you learned from this project so far?
Well, it's been tremendously successful because we've been able to deploy, as I said, nearly 3,000 vehicles, cars, trucks, buses, and motorcycles that can talk to each other. So that means that what we call situation awareness, that is, what is the real situation of proximity of vehicles and, in particular, risks arising that might lead to a collision. And so the vehicles are communicating in such a way that that is being monitored. And ultimately, you know, we need some redundancy in the system as well to be totally reliable, because as you can imagine, when we finally get to a driverless vehicle, we need to have great confidence in the way that technology is going to perform and behave and the reliability of it.
You know, you touched on something that, as I thought about this, popped into my mind over and over again, and that is what it's going to take to train drivers to let go, if you will, and let your car do the driving, because clearly, you've got this self-driving car dealing with red lights and stops at intersections, so I am literally staking my life on that piece of technology working perfectly every time.
Well, exactly. And as we go through the process, we're going to need the driver to come back on duty every now and then. So there are going to be times when the lane markings just aren't there. They're worn out or they're covered in snow or whatever. There are going to be times as we go through this process that the driver is going to have to do something. So the driver is going to be there, and it's almost the opposite of the problem we have now. Right now, we're expecting the driver to do everything, and of course, drivers get distracted. So sometimes the driver can't be relied on to do everything they need to do. It's almost flipping that around so that the driver will be relieved of many tasks, but there are going to be times, critical times, when the attention of the driver has to be directed back to a particular task and a particular need. So that's a pretty important area for research, and it's something that we're very interested in at the university. It's really what we'd call a human factors problem, as to how you accurately attract the attention of the driver back to what they actually need to know. And many of the systems we've been working on the last five, six, 7 years really prepare us pretty well for that kind of situation, because we're increasingly giving drivers warnings about things. So, you know, we detect a risky situation and the driver gets a warning. So that's going to stand us in good stead as we go to these more automated vehicles.
I'm speaking with Peter Swetman, who's the director of the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. And as we think about having these automated vehicles, Peter, I know we see that there can be benefits as far as controlling traffic flow, so fewer traffic jams, fewer accidents. And then talking about as the car takes over tasks, freeing us up to do what? What are we supposed to be doing while that car is doing most of the work?
Well, I think, you know, strangely enough, I think culturally Americans are very attuned to using their time better. And so I think everyone can think of things they can be doing while they're sitting in their vehicle.
Seriously, so, like email and texting?
And some people are already doing it, right?
So, well, yeah, to the detriment of many.
Yeah, so that's a very unsafe behavior, of course. But with these more automated systems, then it's going to be possible to do things like that. And quite safely. So, yeah, people will just generally be able to use their time a lot better while they're traveling in vehicles.
Wow. Well, we know that Google's got its driverless cars. They've already driven over 500,000 miles with no accidents, and Nissan and Tesla and Daimler AG are among those hoping to have self-driving vehicles available within the next year. So this is happening. This is not just, hey, let's see what we can do in a research setting.
Yeah, we're really coming to a tipping point where, you know, industrially and from a commercial point of view, we need to make this successful. So it's not commercially successful at the moment, and that's going to be the true test, because we need to be able to get these systems out there on a very large scale to get the benefits. You know, you touched on the safety benefits, the fact that we still have over 32,000 fatalities every year in this country. So these kind of systems will make the biggest potential impact on that we've ever had the opportunity to do, and that's why we're very excited about it. But also the way traffic moves, so we don't have to stop and start so often. So many, many benefits are going to impact energy use. It's going to impact the environmental impact of vehicles. So one of the things that we're doing to really accelerate this process is at the University of Michigan, we're going to build a test facility, which is actually on the campus, on the university campus, to actually test these vehicles safely, to test automated and connected vehicles off-road in a safe manner. So we're actually building what we call a fake downtown, so that we're actually putting up some pretty complex urban situations with pedestrians suddenly appearing between parked cars and all that kind of thing, to make sure that these automated systems are capable of dealing with those systems time and time again in a very reliable manner.
So, Peter, let's say it's 2021. The goal has been met. There is a fleet of self-driving cars, automated cars, ready to hit the road in Ann Arbor. So here we're going to have some cars with self-driving capabilities and then the rest of us who don't have that. So even if you're in your self-driving car with automatic braking, I can still run into you with my car. I mean, how will the haves and the have-nots be interfacing?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, but they definitely will interface. So we don't envisage that we're going to have special private lanes for these kinds of vehicles. So these automated vehicles will coexist with other vehicles. And, of course, some of the work being done here at the university already in the College of Engineering shows that we can have a mix of technology levels out there working together pretty successfully. So we don't need to have all automated vehicles in order to operate safely.
Well, it strikes me that we're kind of perhaps at the threshold of the same period in history when people were looking at that strange horseless carriage going down the road thinking, who would ever get behind the wheel of that automated thing when you could hitch up a team of horses and carry you? Who would do that? And we found out it did. It worked and it happened.
Yes, who knew we needed that? Who knew we actually wanted that kind of capability, that kind of technology? So sometimes the technology comes along and provides us with an opportunity that we've just got to take. But I must say that there's a lot more than the technology involved in this as far as we're concerned, because we need to come up with systems that are going to really work for users. So, for example, we think these new mobility machines will be automated and connected, but they'll probably be shared as well. So you'll be able to call up a mobility machine in Ann Arbor with your smartphone, and you get taken to where you want to go. You don't need to park it or anything like that. So the impact on parking, the need for parking in cities, will be substantial. So you can imagine the improvement to our downtown areas when we don't need so much parking. So there will be many, many additional benefits that people are going to like. And we're really working on something here that everyone in the community is going to benefit from, and the users are going to just love it, and that's our aim.
Peter Sweatman, the director of the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute, thanks for talking with us today. As always, it's a pleasure talking with you, Peter.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
It is, of course, Veterans Day, and you don't have to look too hard on social media to find tributes and thanks to veterans. One of my friends noted he can never remember seeing so many online tributes to and reminders of the importance of Veterans Day as he has today, and he has a good point. Perhaps it's seeing so many moving videos of American warriors returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan to their families, or profiles of wounded vets who are building brave new lives despite losing limbs or suffering other grievous injuries. Perhaps it's seeing the way Vietnam vets are reaching out to veterans from the Persian Gulf, Iraq, and Afghanistan, making sure those who served in the Middle East got a much better welcome home than those Vietnam troops were given when they came home from battle. Thankfully, we have moved beyond the spitting on and taunting our veterans the way some were greeted upon their return from Vietnam. Perhaps it's the growing awareness that we are quickly losing our veterans of Korea and World War II. Recent Veterans Administration figures say we're losing over 600 World War II vets each and every day. Clearly, there is no time left to lose to honor their sacrifice and to say thank you. From 2006 to 2010, it was my privilege to be a volunteer for Honor Flight Michigan and to accompany Michigan World War II veterans on their special flights to visit their memorial in Washington. We've posted a few photos that I took on those flights on our stateside Facebook page in the hopes that they capture the emotions of those very special honor flights and those very special Greatest Generation veterans. Thank you to all who served. And let's keep something important in mind. As troops exit Afghanistan and the U.S. military downsizes, millions of ex-service members are pouring into a job market where post-9/11 veterans already grapple with a 10.1% unemployment rate, far higher than the national average. So, yes, let's keep thanking our veterans and let's keep posting those Facebook tributes. But as a society, let's also think about what can be done to support our veterans and their families, from World War II right on up through to Iraq and Afghanistan. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.